Well, hello there, and thank you for joining us. I'm your host, Stephen Kowalczyk, and tonight we're serving up a heaping helping of inspirational stories, thought-provoking topics, and unique perspectives. I hope you came hungry, because you're about to devour an addictive podcast. So we're here with Faith McFluff. Hello, Faith.
Hi, Steve.
How you doing today?
Oh, I'm fabulous. In fact, I'm absolutely fabulous.
We are going to dig into your brain a little bit and ask a lot of questions. We want to know more about the processes involved with that kind of creative thinking and execution, because I've seen a lot of your work and it's pretty spectacular. So tell me about yourself a little bit, Faith. Tell me how you even got to the point to where we're sitting here at Meet the Mixologist.
Oh, wow. I mean, there's so many different points. You want to talk about how I ended up into mixology?
Yeah, okay, absolutely.
Perfect. So my dad loved beer.
What was his favorite beer?
He loved an ice cold Foster's. He drank those big
cans. Good.
Or Beck's.
Those were really big at the time.
They were. But they were the better beers at the time of what you were able to get, you know, readily available, because the craft beer movement hadn't really hit.
Absolutely.
So I loved pouring his beer for him as a kid, and like he taught me the proper way to make a black and tan. Like that was
Is he Australian?
No,
he just loved that drink.
Yes, he loved black and tans, and there was a second where we didn't have any spoons that weren't like bent into black and tan spoons.
Oh, shit,
so I think
funny.
I was 12 when I learned how to
Did
make
you
like
take
the perfect
to
black.
School for show
time. It really is Foster's food. It really is. It's science is what it is. And I think that's what fascinated me so much about it.
Yeah.
And the fact that when you drank it, it still stayed separated if you did it properly.
And that was the moment you were really remember.
Yes. So I want to say I was like 11 or 12 when I was making like perfect black and tans.
That's so funny, because people even now struggle with making a perfect black and tan.
So I want to say that's my first like mixology, quote unquote, moment.
That's beer mixology.
So eventually I ended up becoming an exchange student in Germany. I was 16 and I made lots of friends there. And at the time, round trip airfare was $199. I worked at a coffee shop, so it was easy to save up the money to travel back and forth.
A barista?
Yeah, I was a barista.
Man, that's a good starter move for a bartender too, because it teaches you how to work within a close, confined space and have to execute all these different things.
And also how to make a bunch of drinks in a rush, line up the cups and just
bang,
keep.
Bang, bang.
Yep. And also, you know, just it helps you keep the rhythm. So I was a barista, and I made a good amount of money, so I was able to save up money and go back and forth every time. There was a spring break, summer break. I have my family also lives in Italy, so I was able to go over there and learn a lot of culinary techniques, because they're still in a little mountain town with a wood-burning oven outside.
I love that.
Yeah. So that's also where I got introduced to the Amari family.
For real?
Yeah.
What age were you?
I first went over there when I was 8, and I remember having limoncello. After dinner.
That's crazy. And Averna.
And
oh my
like,
God,
and
you know how many people don't know about it now? I just did cut two events last week and I'm
like,
do you
want to
know
how traumatizing that is for an 8-year-old? And you're like, let me have a sip of that. You're like,
what? Yeah.
I had grappa at 12 when I went over there.
They don't believe in alcohol anonymous over there. It's just like, hey, just drink. Everybody drink.
It is, but you know, I think that also helped me develop a palate for it later. Like,
because
your palate changes every 7 years. So you prefer more bitter things as you age. And that's why you get people like around like 28 to 30, they start preferring those more bitter flavors. But children don't like bitter. They prefer sweet. So you can drink the same drink, but, you know, my palate had already been developed.
Interesting.
And also the German Kräuterlikör.
Kräuterlikör.
Each city has their own version of Jägermeister, call it Kräuterlikör, and they sell it in the little airline bottles, like where you would buy gum in the grocery store.
Yeah.
And it's just sort of like the 5-hour energy. It's like, me just have a little like little Underberg.
a little Underberg. for
just a little note, and that's just, you know, the culture. So
that's great.
That's where I really first got into it, except, you know, the drinks I was mixing over there as a 16-year-old in Germany were terrible.
What were you mixing over there?
So I had a friend that was a bartender at our little local Kneiper, a little pub.
Yeah.
And the Don Faith was actually the good one. I wore a little, like, mobster hat, and they started calling me Don Faith. And because in European bars, they always have a coffee machine. So I was a barista, and sometimes I wanted booze in my coffee. So he would make me a proper latte, and he would put Frangelico and whiskey in the latte.
Really? Do you remember what kind of whiskey? Was it scotch?
No. It was whiskey, but I can't remember what type. I think maybe it was just like his well whiskey because I was 16.
Someone's making whiskey.
But I specifically requested Frangelico because I knew it had that nice nutty flavor. And then I would have him put Bailey's in with the milk when he frothed it up.
Right
and,
on, yeah. Oh,
and
wow.
then a little
oh,
bit
wow.
of whipped cream on top,
oh,
cinnamon and nutmeg.
That. That's fantastic.
And that was the Dawn Faith. That was like my drink that I would always get. And, like,
and
I,
this is what age?
16.
Damn. I had no idea that you were
old
like that at 16.
Yeah.
I don't even want to tell you what I was doing at 16.
But you want to know what else? No. You want to know what else I was drinking at 16 living in Germany? And I really just think this was the bartender punishing us because he was our friend. which is what happens when you have 16-year-olds that are able to drink in bars because it's Germany. Because
your 15-year-old friend is hooking you up.
Well, no, I think he was like 20. He was definitely dating one of my friends.
Yeah.
But he would put everything, he would take Unmaß, like one of those big liter glasses that you would see, like, you know, in the Hofbräuhaus that people would be cheersing with. So he would take that and he would just go down the line of everything he had, like the same like way that you go through the well for a long time, but he would just go with everything.
It's like a suicide for the well.
Oh, no, down to hot sauce, salt, and pepper.
Oh, okay.
And then he would put it in the middle of the table, and mind you, this thing was $20, and it would get all maybe, you know, 6 to 8 of us drunk, so it was totally worth it in our eyes.
Drunk you were.
And drunk you were. And he, like, it would be like Sprite, Coke. That's it was crazy. Literally like everything you get a hands on, and then we would connect all of the straws together so they'd be super long, and you wouldn't have to get up to suck out of this giant pitcher. Because he wouldn't give us glasses
like
for that price.
Kids games with the booze. That's funny.
So, you know, while I did have the Dawn Faith going on at 16, you're respecting me for that, you can also appreciate the fact that I drank whatever suicide mission that was.
God bless you.
Oh, I also made my own absinthe. I don't think I was, I think it was on one of my later trips. Maybe I was like 18. No, I was 16. Okay. I still had very low alcohol standards. That this is actually the landmark case as to why if something bounces when I drop it, I don't drink it. That's my rule.
Wait, what do you mean?
If you take a bottle and it bounces when you drop it,
even
I don't drink
it. Even if it's
glass? Glass shouldn't bounce when you drop it.
That's what I'm saying. If it did, that would be pretty spectacular. You're like,
would.
I'm definitely
it
not
would,
drinking that. Even though it didn't break, you're like, I want to, but I won't.
It's my rule of don't drink things that come in plastic bottles.
Okay,
you're always going to regret it.
That's so funny.
We ended up making absinthe while you still were able to legally buy absinthe.
Yeah.
And I would smuggle it back in Listerine bottles all the time. Like,
huh.
I don't know what they thought about, you know, this girl living out of a backpack, and they were going through all of my luggage, which was
so
literally
funny.
A backpack, but I would somehow had a full bottle of Listerine.
No, sir.
No. Well, they would confiscate your alcohol, and absinthe was also illegal. So
and about the size. Yeah. They didn't take the, small, like you take a bottle of shampoo or something and they throw it away.
Oh yeah, but this
oversized.
this was pre-9/11. Well, this
or
was post 9/11, but
yeah.
You know, pre like all the super close restrictions, you were still able to fly with a liter of Listerine in your backpack
that's
and your
crazy.
Carry-on. So that's how I would get all the absinthe back, but I decided to make my own absinthe while I was there. I remember we ordered the herbs on eBay, and I think we had them shipped from somewhere in the Netherlands. We made our own absinthe with, like, their version of, like, you know,
isn't that
kombucha.
Highly dangerous?
Like, probably. So here's the thing. What happened? Germany has all of these large, like, fountains that are left over from, you know, like, the Renaissance period. And these castles. So we were drinking in front of a castle. And you've got, if you can imagine, their goth kids are all very ornate. Like, they dress like they're, like, in an Edgar Allan Poe poem all the time. They only have, like, 3-4 outfits because they're all very expensive.
But they wear the hell out of them.
And so if you can imagine all of these, like, gothic kids and then a couple of punks all drinking this absinthe. And it tasted terrible because we used, like, the cheapest vodka we could find because we were 16. We didn't know
and
any better.
Wormwood and everything?
The wormwood and other herbs. And it was... It was not green. It was brown.
Oh.
it was the I remember just like the smell of it made you want to vomit, which is why
I'm drinking absinthe now, let alone.
But it's why I know now you had to burn the sugar in it, like the whole absinthe. Because basically, what I made is what alcohol was back then. Like alcohol now tastes much better than it used to, which is why you had to do things like burn sugar into it and add water to even make it palatable. Now it's just to try to like get the anise flavor down a little bit, but then it was all about like this alcohol is literally bad. So choked that down, and it actually, it is pretty trippy. People say like, oh, it wasn't the wormwood, it was the no, I really, whatever. It was a sad, trippy drug. Like everyone ended up crying on the inside of like an old fountain.
Cry sometimes helps turn.
You know, but if you can imagine, like eight goth kids all like crying. Oh my god,
they already have stuff to cry about, and suddenly it's like, here it comes.
Yeah, here it comes. So you know, that's my experience with homemade absinthe at 16, living in Germany.
That's crazy.
So I've been making my own, you know, liquor and my own drinks for a while.
I think that's fantastic. Now bring this up to date. So how did you end up in Pittsburgh?
Well, I'm from Ohio, and there comes a time in most young Ohioans' lives where they decide it's time to leave Ohio.
And move to the big city?
Kind of. So originally, I knew I just had to leave Ohio, and I moved to Kelly's Island, and I knew that that was going to...
That just went really small, but
I kind of got out of Ohio. I got out of mainland Ohio and went to the water, and I knew that that would buy me some time to find my next spot, and I knew I wanted to go tropical. So I was working at a cocktail bar up there, and it was almost like cocktail camp because I was living in a small cottage with the head chef right on the beach. It was gorgeous, but I didn't have any internet. I didn't have a working phone. I could get internet at work sometimes, or if I went in the library parking lot, because it was a very tiny town in the middle of the water, and you have to take a boat even back and forth to go buy groceries. So it was pretty secluded.
That's fun.
I did have Amazon, and I was able to take some money and invest it in a lot of books. So I bought, I think it was like $600 worth of mixology books, and I didn't really have anything to do because I didn't really drink that much. Like, that was the only thing that people really did after work was just go out and drink. I would just read books. So I read a lot of mixology books, and I had my own little personal bar at home. And every time I would go to the mainland, I'd invest in a couple of more bottles and a few more ingredients and a couple more things of bitters, because there's not even a liquor store on the island. So every time you get off, you just you get your supplies and then you bring them back. And I felt like that was prepping me for a future island life in a more secluded island, not one that was so connected to a mainland. So I was able to almost have like a cocktail camp. I lived with head chef, and because it's such a small town that's landlocked,
but that had to help, because then you learned to really buy flavor profiles on a cooking level.
I did, and because all of the restaurant people were all connected there, we all just like rode bikes and golf carts to each other's houses. That's I did little pop-up bars everywhere, and I was able to actually test a lot of my cocktails, what was good, what wasn't. And I threw a lot of parties. Just because there's not really much else to do on an island when you're not working. So that is from that step, how I thought I was going to get even more out of Ohio. I thought I was going to go to St. John and work at a small place there. And two hurricanes happened back to back. So the place I was supposed to live and the place I was supposed to work just didn't exist anymore. So I ended up finding myself back in Ohio. I got a job at a small little French bakery with a bar. And that ended up going out of business as well. And I just was looking for anywhere to get out of Ohio. I think I went on a road trip to Columbus, Cincinnati, and Pittsburgh, because those are the closest places.
You
went
on a trip too, so you came and checked it out for a minute.
Yeah. I wanted to just check out what I was looking at on Craigslist in person, rather than, you know, trying to find things just on the internet. And those were the closest places
I could go. What was the first town or first neighborhood you moved to in Pittsburgh?
I moved to Brookline, and actually, I came here just to visit a friend of mine who had married somebody from Pittsburgh, and they bought a house here in Brookline, and I loved it. I ended up deciding to move here within like 24 hours
Fantastic.
Of the trip.
What was it, Pittsburgh or the neighborhood or both or the person you were going to move in with?
All of it. So knowing that I could have a landlord that I could trust because she's my friend.
Yeah.
And she's also living in the apartment. So it's all in our best interest to have a nice, healthy, working house. Yeah. You know, not something that has like mold or leaks in it. Like they actually repair it.
That's important. It is really important. Take advantage of like that.
And no security deposit, and I cleaned the house for my first month's rent.
Oh, that got you moved.
Yeah, it was a construction site. Oh, that's great. Within an hour of that, we went and had lunch with somebody. I was in this my landlord's wedding. Went and had lunch with somebody that was also in the wedding, and he was moving out of the country.
Yeah.
He was actually my very first cleaning client in Pittsburgh.
Oh, wow.
He hired me to do his final move-out clean, and everything that I wanted, I could just have.
So like right away, you had a little bit of work, you had a place to stay.
I had a place to stay, and I assumed that...
Be around.
I assumed when I was moving out of the country and also moved into employee housing on Kelly's Island that I was like just done with Ohio. I gave away most of my things.
Yeah.
So within an hour... I had an apartment full of whatever furniture I needed, even down to like trash bags and sponges, like literally everything I needed. And then I had a lot of things to sell on Craigslist.
Yeah.
So it all, Pittsburgh happened to me. I didn't really.
Oh, yeah. I like the way you put that. That's fantastic.
And I've grown so much here and met so many wonderful people. And I understand why, you know, when things happen easily, it's because you're meant to be there.
Yeah, true that. No, that's good. That's good. So what was the first interaction with the Pittsburgh bar scene? Like, where did you get a job at or did you start right
so
away?
So that's actually another reason why I was so convinced that I could move to Pittsburgh because, funny story, Pittsburgh's number one employer is actually the hospitality industry. It is not the banking industry. Funny. It is not it's not the hospital
that's
scene
crazy.
Here. It's
I could see that
we have
now.
So many bars and restaurants, and we keep on opening up more every year.
Like sometimes 40, 50, 60 a year.
Yeah, and so that makes it really easy to find a job. But I also realize that the talent pool is very thinly stretched because of that. And it's,
yeah,
because
there you got some rock stars, and then once they move around a little bit, everybody opens up other places and wants to do the same type of thing. But without the true talent, you don't really go anywhere with it.
Well, I call it a lot of beautiful disasters. You have a lot of people that put a lot of money into building beautiful concepts, and they're very well thought out. But because there isn't the infrastructure there or even the management to try to run them, it's very hard to try to execute them. And that's why there's so much going on in this bar and restaurant scene. I see us progressing so quickly. The only thing that I'm worried is that we don't have the talent pool to keep up with it. And there's going to be a bubble that bursts, and it has in several other cities. My question is, how do we solve it? Like, how do we spread the education around so that all these people that want these jobs that are here.
You could truly go to the average bar and get a terrible drink. Or the bartender only knows how to do duos like rum and coke, vodka tonics. And the thing is like, it's the ego. Everybody thinks they're like this rock star. And even if you're like an uneducated bartender that strictly tends the bar, make sure everybody has something in their hands. Mm-hmm. That's great. But then if you don't even know how to make like a balanced whiskey sour or, you know, some, even hell, you might not even know balance in a duo. You might make overly strong drinks because you don't get it. Like you think that pouring more liquor is going to get you more tips. All you're doing is securing the fact that you won't have a job for very long because the owner recognizes that they are losing money. Cause that's the other thing is uneducated owners that own bars that they're losing money constantly and they don't know what to do about it. Sorry, I went off on a tangent
fine.
Obviously being sponsored by Steel City Mixology, the Devour and Addictive podcast likes to focus on education of people and talking about things that are important. And that's definitely one of our true soft spots is the fact that you still can go out and get crappy drinks almost anywhere you go, except for a few places that the bartenders and mixologists really know what they're doing, you know? So let me ask you this. So you came to Pittsburgh, you got into the bar scene, you said, what was the first place that you started working? Or you don't want to say? Okay, so let's say we don't answer that question, right? Okay, perfect. So it's somewhere in Pittsburgh.
Somewhere in the south side of Pittsburgh.
A bad experience. When did you jump into your first competition? Because I know you're an award-winning mixologist. Yeah. What was your first competition?
Geez, Steve. So my first competition was actually where I met your other host, Hugh Qualchek.
That's me, by
It
way.
Was the Woodford Reserve Manhattan competition.
Fantastic.
And actually, while I was on Kelly's Island, Kelly's Island is kind of where all of the liquor reps love to go.
Yeah.
Because it's a paid vacation, sure. Basically. You get the boat ride paid for out to the island. Okay. They give you a golf cart.
Wink, wink. You know?
Work. And, you know, it's a gorgeous account to have. Yeah. And that's actually how I started going out there, was as a liquor promo model. And that's a whole other story of my involvement with the liquor industry.
Wow.
But so I end up having stories. A lot of liquor reps come through and try some of my cocktails. And one of my cocktails that I made from local lilacs that were on the island, because what I like to do was go foraging and then find ways to make cocktails from the ingredients
that I
found.
That's my next question for you, but we'll get to that.
So I had a lilac cocktail, and all the reps said, this is a competition cocktail. This could really
do
well.
Nice.
And that kind of planted that seed of, well, I should just start entering these competitions that I find. I think I'm good enough.
And then you got to Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm.
And then I got to Pittsburgh. I found the Woodford Manhattan competition. Nice. They actually sent
That's
me up.
That's solid competition
yeah,
right
it
there.
It is. They set me up next to Steve, and
That's
I did.
Once again.
Yeah. I
was in it, too.
He was in it, too. But here's the thing is we both had smoked cocktails.
Yeah.
And we had different style smokers and different smoking techniques. Yeah. So we ended up connecting on that and realizing that we had a very similar style of mixology.
Well, I have to be honest. Mm-hmm. When I saw your stylings, I dug it completely. And you put out a couple pictures, and I was always already a Facebook friend, friend, quote unquote. You know, like we didn't meet each other yet. But I was watching these pictures that were very nature based. You know, you were in trees or flowers or picking something that was in a cocktail and utilizing vintage things like, I believe, a teapot and a teacup. And it's so impressive to me. And I'm not afraid of competition. In fact, competition breeds success. So the fact that I get to watch this and think about things that I love and how you applied them differently to your thing, that's pretty remarkable. And at the same time, I hope I do that for other people too. Like we're all unique in our creativity, and I want that to be known, you know? So that's a huge thing, the foraging for you, is it not?
It is. So while I was on Kelly's Island, you know, without the phone or the internet, which honestly, it was really nice to be unplugged for a summer, but it was also really nice to plug back in
and get
back to reality a little bit. I was spending a lot of time foraging because that island is owned mostly by the Natural History Museum.
So everything's just
pristine. And it feels a lot like St. John did, which is why I wanted to move between the two, because St. John is Rockefeller's old private island, and most of it's now a national park.
Oh, awesome.
So it's pristine, like that's private what Pirates of the Caribbean looked like.
Yeah, that's great.
And Kelly's Island is full of fossils. Like all in the glaciers carved out into the rock formations, you can just see fossils.
That's great.
Mm-hmm. So I spent a lot of time in nature and seeing what I could eat. Like my favorite saying was, ooh, what's that? Can I eat it? and I started out by finding...
That thought pattern might get you in trouble at some point.
It can. But I started out, well, now when I could plug in,
I would research.
Yeah. And the best thing to start out with is, what's edible and bloom in my region right now?
Oh, yeah.
Does it have any poisonous
lipids? Oh, yeah. Now you know all that stuff, and you can go right for those items.
And there's also some really nice apps now when you aren't plugged in where you can take a picture of something, and it tells you what it thinks it is, and you can actually have a little bit more guidance for your research.
Nice.
And that's with that research, cool you can think like, oh, well, now I know that there's no poisonous lookalikes for an oyster mushroom in North America. Yeah. So if I see something that looks like an oyster... I just need to make sure it doesn't have bugs on it.
Yeah, that's crazy. That's great.
So I also I didn't have that much money while I was on this island. It was very expensive to live there. So foraging my ingredients was one of the ways that I could actually, you know, throw these awesome parties and make these great syrups and bitters and things like that. Because I had a lot of time in my hands.
That's next level. Yeah. Like you get it for free and you create something truly next level. That I could see why you're in competitions, because that type of... the way that you're using these natural ingredients is just pretty impressive.
So I'm not done with that island yet. Yeah. So that entire island is covered in juniper.
Really?
I love gin. I would love to make a Kelly's Island gin out of nothing but ingredients that are foraged from the island.
That's pretty interesting.
That's my one goal. So this year right now I have a creme de vie a lot sitting around. Yep. So violet flowers grow everywhere. And while they're normally French violets that they would use for that, the wild violets that we had
here. You mean the little purple ones? Yeah, I have a ton of them in my backyard.
Not anymore. Not now, they're seasonal if you know how to plant it. That's why I was always out during violet season.
Plant those. They're just
so if you collect just the petals, they actually have a butterfly PT effect where it changes colors from purple to with fuchsia acid with acid. Shift. And the same thing will happen if you steep it long enough and basically like a sugared vodka.
That's awesome. Yeah. Let me ask you another question, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
We're really enjoying our conversation, though, by the way. So thank you for coming in. So what do you see as a new trend or the future trends of the industry, let's say local and nationally?
I mean, honestly, you just said it. Local.
Oh, just local. Everything local for
local. Like getting as local as
local
you can.
Local honeys, local spirits, local foraging for products or for items that you can
local
use.
Local fruit when it's in season.
Yeah. Coming from the farms, like everything just. Man, that could,
farm
could,
to table and garden
farm
to
bar.
Glass.
Yeah.
Well, garden to glass mostly. I like seeing that. Bars planting their own bars for their garnishes.
Oh, yeah.
Are planting their own gardens for their garnishes. That's even using the community garden space, depending on where you are.
Oh, yeah, because there's some really big gardens out there.
Or rooftop space. There are a couple places that I've worked where we had a garden just out back around the side. And, you know, whenever you were coming in for your shift, you went and harvested what you needed.
That's great.
Yeah.
What do you see as a national trend?
Honestly, I see it becoming more natural, like getting rid of artificial colors and flavors. I'm seeing a lot of people come down. Like, I love Campari. That is honestly, it's the first thing I ordered in a bar when I turned 21.
That's an interesting choice.
I see a lot of people, it's because I really wanted to know what it tasted like. I had worked as a cocktail waitress.
Yeah, because you had that developed palate, so you were interested in that
stuff. Yeah, but also as a cocktail waitress.
I remember it sitting on a shelf. I never knew what to do with it. I didn't taste it. I didn't even taste it.
I thought it tasted like cherry. I thought it would taste like cherry.
Oh, it would taste
like cherry. Because it's red.
That's that color relationship.
And that color relationship, you also think it's going to be sweet.
What does purple tomato juice taste like?
I don't know. But also the color relationship, you would associate red with sweet.
Oh, absolutely.
So, you know, 21-year-old Faith thought that Campari was...
Yeah, you got the opposite on that one, boy.
I ordered a Campari and soda, and that was like, ugh! But I drank it. That was my money.
That's fantastic. Did someone tell you to mix it with something, or you just ordered it by itself?
I ordered Campari and soda because I was a cocktail waitress at that point in time, and I served it, but I was never allowed to try it. So I was just
one was believing in cocktail education or spirit education at that time.
Actually, I worked at the Marriott and I felt like I had an amazing spirit education for what was available at the time. This was like 2006.
Oh, you did? Yeah, you had worldly experience.
Yeah, well, worldly, but also the Marriott had a very good education program.
Oh, they were
coming
dealing
in from
up some
zero.
Good education for
yeah,
you.
Because
yeah, good.
I came in as a room service server.
Up to Marriott.
I came in as a room service server at 19, or 18, and you weren't allowed to serve alcohol in Ohio until you were 19.
Yeah.
So they had me sitting in room service till my 19th birthday, and then they had me sitting as a cocktail waitress until my 21st birthday. And they gave me some amazing liquor education and also just education on, you know, how to make a cocktail. They had a jigger regulation back when everyone was like, what's a jigger? Well, you had to pour everything into a jigger and
absolutely.
Everything
That's
had to
how
be
you,
measured.
I teach that to every place that I do consulting work. It's got to happen because you measure everything and now you know. Mm-hmm. And you could say if everybody's doing that, then it's specific, you know.
But going back to what's going to be a national trend, I think because education is a lot easier to get, thinking, you know, well, what was acceptable in 2006? A jigger was like, oh, they make you guys use a jigger for everything. I just free pour it. A lot
so you're
has changed.
The trend will be more of standardized pouring.
Standardized
pouring
and also just people knowing how to make basic drinks and just standard regulations. Because if you think about it, what you can try to say, what's the industry standard for this? And there really is no industry standard for anything. Or
people like to think there is, but
there's not.
Honestly, the industry standard is total chaos.
There is, and it varies from place to place. So I think you're going to get a lot more places saying what their personal standards are. And from that, you might get a more defined industry standard of what's acceptable.
Wow, that's cool. Okay, so I have two questions for you. All right. if you could make any drink for somebody, what would it be and who would it be for? And you get to share it with them. So you both get to sip on this drink together.
Oh, so definitely Snoop Dogg.
Okay. Definitely. Okay. And what would you make for him?
So I recently had a competition beverage for an event with Copper and Kings Brandy.
Yeah.
And with Copper and Kings mixtape, you have to make a drink to a song.
Oh, nice.
And I've always actually thought, you know, they have that game, like, fuck, marry, kill. Yeah. Well, I have who would you like to have over for dinner? I think that that's a lot nicer.
Sounds like a totally different game.
Yeah, it's a totally different game. It's the nice version of it. It's a real nice version. But it gives you an idea of, like, someone's personality. No one gets fucked or killed. No. Okay. Or nobody needs to get married either.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But I always say that I would love to have both Martha Stewart and Snoop Dogg over for dinner.
Oh, man, those two together are amazing.
They are together, yeah. But you
want to
talk about...
They're so different, but so the same, too. They've got the same type of personality.
Yes. You want to talk about an awesome dinner party. And I've often thought about, like, you know those big copper pineapples?
Yeah.
Like, there's just so many glassware that I look at that I'm like, if I ever have Snoop Dogg and Martha Stewart over for dinner, that's when I'm going to get it. But yeah. I don't need this, you know, $75 pineapple right now.
That's great. I saw that $75 pineapple and I wanted to buy it too, I'll be honest with you.
So I thought it out. Okay. But when it actually came around time for this competition, I chose the song Fruit Juice by Snoop Lion, which is actually Snoop Dogg's Rastafarian resurrection of himself.
That's great. Coming back.
I took a lot of the fruits that were mentioned in the song, and I ended up making a cocktail out of it with their history of lovers, rose and honey and strawberry gin from Copper and Kings.
Oh,
it's honestly
fantastic.
It is the best gin I've ever tried, and I thought that their American dry gin was literally
Shout out
to Copper and Kings, man. So I thought that their gin was the best gin that I've ever tried, and somehow they topped it.
Oh my.
So, you know, there's almost like a little tear I have to wipe away from my eyes. They somehow just made my best gin even better. But, you know, you add honey and strawberries and hibiscus and rose to anything, and
forget
it does get better.
About it.
So I ended up using that in a tiki style drink, and he talks about having a honeycomb hideaway in the song Fruit Juice. So I took a honeycomb from a friend's farm and an inverted lime, and I filled the lime with brandy and the honeycomb, so you had a little, like, a brandy snack.
My heart skips a beat.
There was a CBD gummy underneath the umbrella that I put in there, because, you know, you have a honeycomb hideaway that needs an umbrella.
Of course.
And I would really just love to share my beverage dedicated to Snoop Dogg
him.
And, you know, he's always been that dream dinner guest of mine.
Yeah. That's great.
Yeah, but, you know, I've also had this conversation. I would not want to be Snoop Dogg's bestie. That seems like a lot of commitment and work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's a very good answer.
Every time I see the artist Space Jesus perform, just the way that he is, the way he performs, I just want to be his bestie. That's seems like he'd be a nice low maintenance bestie.
Okay.
But Snoop Dogg, he seems like he has a lot of secrets. Mm. I don't need a lot of maintenance.
See, we all have some secrets.
But you know.
That's good. Okay, so ready for the last question?
Yes.
This gets a little bit harder. Maybe not.
Maybe not.
Basically, you knew that tomorrow you're going to die.
Okay.
Today would be the day that you make your very last cocktail for yourself.
Ooh.
What would it be and why would you choose that cocktail?
A Negroni.
A Negroni, really?
Because when life gets tough, a Negroni tastes great. I honestly
can't argue with that.
Yeah, no, like I realized, you know, I had kind
of
a tough time on
that. That was quick. I love it.
It's
shout out to
Campari
once again.
Yeah, and you know, I like to add one part Luxardo to that Negroni. And that's actually, I call it
a part or take a modified part.
Okay, so it ends up being four parts instead of three.
Oh, okay.
And it's just one part Luxardo.
It's a bigger drink of delicious.
It's a bigger drink of delicious too. And if I'm going to die.
How long have you been doing that?
That actually started when I moved to Pittsburgh. That was my shift bev at the end of the night.
What
would
you call that version?
I call it a luxury Negroni because of the Luxardo.
Oh.
And it makes me feel when you get really luxurious, you do a topper of Prosecco.
Jesus.
Yeah.
That sounds fantastic.
It just, you know.
Loose ice or a big cube?
I stir it first, I strain it, and then I top it with the Prosecco, and I add the orange.
Oh, yeah, no ice at all.
No ice.
No ice, just strain it. Oh, wow, so you're...
I'm doing it, and preferably, if I'm feeling really fancy, it's in a coupe. Good.
Okay, oh, okay. Wow.
But, yeah, nice. When I really enjoy it, it's in one of those stemmed mason jars. And I'll so you have a mason jar. I think it's called a redneck wine glass. So you have a stemmed mason jar. And I do.
You had me up until the redneck wine glass.
Okay, but no. Okay. But when I do it with ice, it's in the redneck mason jar.
It kind of makes sense because you get to
and
just
with a
kick
straw,
it.
Yeah. and I'm just kicking it.
That casualizes a very sophisticated cocktail enough to where you could drink it anywhere.
And going back to the foraging part, seasonally, depending on where I am, whatever I'm picking is in there. So if it's elderflower, I've got a bunch of elderflower in there. If it's rose, I've just got some roses in there.
Fantastic.
If I've got mint lying around. Mint is great in it, especially if you're sipping it in the summertime during the day.
I love it. I love it. Faith, it's been such a pleasure sitting and talking to you. I'm really glad we got to meet the mixologist. Please come back and join us for another segment. Let's figure out something new to talk about because I can see where this runs deep and I like to be able to spin it off of what we've spoken about before. So please come back again.
Thanks for having me, Steve, on Devour, an addictive podcast.